In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking with Evan Thomas. He's assistant managing editor of Newsweek magazine, and he has authored a recent biography of Robert Kennedy. The title of the book is Robert Kennedy, His Life, published by Simon & Schuster. The book came out last fall. In fact, we were scheduled to talk with Evan Thomas in November about this book, and then he got caught up covering the aftermath of the election in Florida. And now, finally, we've got him back on the program, and we're pleased that he's going to take some time and talk with us this morning. Of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So 333-WILL. And toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Any point here, people have questions, they're welcome to call. All we ask of callers is just that you try to keep your comments brief so we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many people as would like to call. Mr. Thomas, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure.
We appreciate it. You had the opportunity to use some material, to take advantage of some material that would not have been available before. Also, you were able to look at some of Robert Kennedy's papers that had been kept in the Kennedy Library. And apparently, you're the first guy, first person, as far as we know, since Arthur Schlesinger published his biography in 1978 to do that. And I'm curious, is it just the case that other people hadn't asked, or had other people asked and the folks at the Kennedy Library said no?
They've asked, all right. The family still owns the papers. I mean, this is something that shouldn't be the case. So this is a federally supported library. All those papers ought to be open. But the Robert Kennedy family still owns the Robert Kennedy papers. So even though they're stored there and you, the taxpayer, are paying for it, they're not open. So I had to, it took quite a while. I had to persuade the family to let me in. Now, I shouldn't be too harsh here because they did let me in, for which I am grateful. But those papers all ought to be open.
When we think of the Kennedys, I think we think of a group of people that, while certainly flawed, are also outgoing, ambitious, bright, capable, attractive, and on and on. And what's very striking, I think, about Robert Kennedy is when he was a boy, when he was a child, he was, in fact, a shy, awkward, had a very difficult time being overshadowed by his older siblings, and in fact, who was it that called him runt? Was it his father?
Yeah, his own father. I mean, you have to remember, this is the era before self-esteem and parents actually being nice to their children. That Kennedy household was very competitive, and the love was handed out to the winners, and the winners were the older kids, Jack and Joe Jr. and Kathleen, that so-called golden trio. They were the ones who were supposed to go on to greatness, to be president or to marry presidents, or to do something for their country and to get the Kennedy family noticed. Bobby was at the lower end of the food chain, partly because he was younger. He's 8 years younger than Jack Kennedy, but also because he just didn't seem to be amounting to anything. His father called him the runt because he was small. By his own description, his hand shook and he fell down a lot. He was painfully shy. There was a lot of sort of quick joshing in this family. They knew how to hand it out and to take it. But Bobby was the sensitive one. His feelings were easily hurt by all this teasing around the dinner table. So to use the cruel modern word, he was a loser. He was not a winner. His grades were poor. He was a mediocre at best athlete. He didn't have a lot of friends. He just didn't measure up.
Yeah. But, of course, this story changed. And, in fact, here, as you write in the prologue, the very striking line, this is the story of an unpromising boy who died as he was becoming a great man.
Well, one of the things that I liked about Bobby Kennedy, and I should say there was a lot not to like, but what I liked about him was that he fought like the devil to overcome his fear and his kind of shaky beginnings. And you can make it now. He was cut down before we ever really found out what kind of a leader, in the grand sense, he would become, what kind of a president he would become. But there's lots of evidence that he was maturing and that his boldness remained. He was willing to do brave things, but also that his judgment was improving and that, you know, who knows, he might have tried to do some very serious and good things for this country had he lived and been elected in 1968.
Yeah. He also, though, in younger, and I think perhaps this here was a tendency that continued into his later life, had a certain reckless drive to prove himself that led him to do things. Like, for example, when he was younger, he had a rather short fuse and he always had a tendency to want to fight with guys who were bigger than he was.
Yeah, that's all true. I mean, this is a guy who seemed to constantly be getting into not just scrapes but fist fights, sometimes to protect his family. He was intensely loyal to this family. For instance, when he was at college during World War II, in an officer's training corps up in Maine, one of the other young men there made some crack about the Kennedys and about Bobby's brother who had actually died on a suicide mission, and Bobby almost killed the guy, came right at him, and they had to pry Bobby's fingers off the guy's neck. So he was a hothead for sure. He had a tremendous temper. And didn't mind fighting, sort of relished fighting. He was not altogether pleasant company generally. I mean, he could be sour and sardonic and cutting.
Hmm. He had trouble in school, although it seems fairly obvious that he was bright, probably as bright as his siblings, and yet he had a tough time. He was in and out of a number of schools. There was one prep school where, in fact, he was involved in cheating.
He was caught cheating at Portsmouth, then called Portsmouth Priory School in Rhode Island.
Why do you think that he had such a tough time in school?
Well, it's a little bit puzzling because, as you say, he was bright. I don't think there's any question about that. But sometimes when you really struggle for something, it makes it harder to get. And he desperately wanted to have good grades and he wanted to do well. But I think the sheer effort was paralyzing. I think he wanted it almost too much, and I think he became defeated and discouraged by his attempts. Now, it is true at the same time, he was never a great intellectual. Let me rephrase that. He became an intellectual in the sense that he certainly read widely as an older man. He read the Greeks, and he read Camus, and he read Emerson. I mean, he became a serious student of intellectual matters. He was never intellectual in the sense that he was never all that great at discussing them in an intellectual way. If you were a university professor talking to Bobby Kennedy about existentialism, I doubt you'd be bowled over by the depth of his analysis. I say this having talked to Saul Bellow, who spent a week with Bobby writing. Bellow was assigned to write an article for Life magazine about RFK, and RFK was constantly trying to pick Bellow's brain about this and that, and Bellows told me that RFK just didn't have the kind of intellectual training to discourse or to analyze that you would expect, say, from an academic. But his intellectual curiosity was there, and I think he was certainly bright.
Mm-hmm. And he saw the military experience of his brothers. He really wanted to be in on the war and to show that he was every bit their equal, although he made it into the Navy, but I think that by this time the war was over.
It bugged him his whole life that he had not seen combat in World War II. It just ate at him because that was, the great test of manhood of his generation, and his oldest brother, Joe Jr., died in a suicide mission flying a bomber across the English Channel aimed at a bomber stuffed with explosives aimed at some submarine pens on the other side. Or, no, I guess it was the V-2 sites. His brother Jack had been proclaimed a hero because his PT boat was cut in half and he'd swum around there in the Pacific rescuing his men. So there was the example of his oldest brother. Bobby never got there. He was always in training during World War II. And by the time he finally got into the Navy, it was 1946, and he spent his Navy time chipping paint on, and this was just sort of rubbed it in, on a destroyer named after his brother Joe. So he never got there, and it really bugged him. I mean, there are all sorts of signs of this. He had a big reception at the White House when his brother was president for all the Medal of Honor winners. He was just in love with the idea of courage, and he wished that he'd had a chance to show it in the sort of ultimate way in battle.
Yeah, and that's an interesting example, and perhaps makes a larger point about his relationship with his brother and his function in the White House. It was Bobby's idea to have them there, but this was really a showcase event for his brother, the president, who was also a hero, for him to kind of press the flesh with other heroes and honor those people, and it's something that Bobby wasn't directly involved in, and yet being on the periphery of that apparently was, I don't know if that was enough, but that was what he got to do.
That it does make a larger point here. I mean, he was showcasing his brother's heroism. He did this. This is while President Kennedy was in office, and Bobby had this reception because he knew that the PR effect would be to associate President Kennedy with these heroes and remind people that President Kennedy, although he hadn't won a Medal of Honor, was himself a hero. So it was all in service of his brother, but it was cooked up by Bobby. And the one who had the real fascination, I mean, I quote Kenny O'Donnell, who was the president's aide, watching Bobby's eyes just fixated on the scene of all these war heroes. I mean, Bobby just absolutely awed to be surrounded by so many brave men.
I should introduce our guest again for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Evan Thomas. He's assistant managing editor of Newsweek magazine and is the author of a recently published biography of Robert Kennedy, which is titled Robert Kennedy, His Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And questions, sir, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, first really became known nationally in the early 50s. He had already worked for his brother and managed his campaign, that's John Kennedy's campaign for the Senate. But when Robert Kennedy really became known is when he went to work for Joe McCarthy. How did that happen?
It is. People who love Bobby Kennedy look back and they just sort of want to forget that Bobby Kennedy worked for Joe McCarthy, who after all was a right-wing demagogue and red-baiter. It happened, first of all, because Joe McCarthy was a family friend of the Kennedys. Joe Kennedy, father Joe, pretty conservative himself, and had ties to Joe Kennedy. In fact, to Joe McCarthy. In fact, Joe McCarthy went out with Robert Kennedy's sisters, one of whom said, described a date with Joe McCarthy as, you'd talk about communism for 30 minutes, and then he would kiss you very hard. So there was a family tie there, but I think that the greater linkage was that Bobby identified with McCarthy as an outsider who wanted to stick it to the WASP establishment. McCarthy may seem like a hideous creature now, today, but at the time there was a lot of sympathy for this tough Irishman who was questioning whether all those guys with striped pants over at the State Department, all those Harvard boys, were actually fellow travelers with the communists. There was an awful lot of support for Joe McCarthy in this quest, and Bobby liked Joe McCarthy's kind of tough guy, tough Irishman image and identified with it because he himself felt like an outsider looking in, didn't really like the preppies at Harvard, and sympathized with McCarthy. Now, he did fairly quickly come to realize that McCarthy's tactics were abusive and unfair and that innocents were being hurt. And he did quit. He was only working for McCarthy for 6 months. And he hated Roy Cohn, who was McCarthy's chief henchman. But initially he was sympathetic to McCarthy.
And how, I guess, I don't want to make too big a point of this, but it was Roy Cohn's sexual orientation something of an issue?
Yes, it was. Bobby Kennedy was a homophobe. He really disliked, I mean, if a shrink would say Bobby Kennedy was probably afraid of Bobby, a shrink who was probing this might wonder if Bobby Kennedy was fearful about his own homosexual inclinations. Now, I have having said that, I have no idea if that's true. But I do know that Bobby was virulently anti-gay. There's lots of evidence of that. And he took an instant dislike to Cohn. And I can't help but believe that part of that wasn't some kind of residual homophobia.
After his involvement with McCarthy, he became chief counsel to a Senate committee looking into labor racketeering. And that was something that an issue that he decided he wanted to take on. I think his father was not terribly happy about that. Maybe other people in the family weren't. Why is it that was something that he grabbed onto?
Yeah, this is an important moment in Bobby Kennedy's life, because here's somebody who had been the most dutiful son, trying to serve his father by advancing his brother's political career and doing what his father wanted and trying to win his father's approval. All of a sudden, here he is investigating, as a Senate investigator, investigating labor racketeering. So he's going after big labor. On the face of it, that's exactly what his father didn't want him to do. And in fact, his father bitterly complained, opposed Bobby doing that, because Jack Kennedy was planning on running for the presidency in 1960, and in those days, well, it's true today, too, but certainly in those days, to run for president as a Democrat, you had to have organized labor on your side. So to be investigating labor racketeering a few years before JFK was going to make his run for the presidency, that did not bode well for Jack Kennedy's political future. So old Joe was against it. Now, again, I'm getting into the realm of psychological theory here, and this book does not pretend to be a psychohistory. I don't use any of the jargon of psychohistory in the book. But historians, including Doris Kearns Goodwin, have wondered whether Bobby's motivations here were complex and psychological. In other words, that in some way he was defying his father as an act of rebellion, that he was doing precisely that thing his father did not want him to do, as in a way of kind of covertly or even unconsciously getting back at his father. The other element here is that Joe Kennedy himself had some, unclear how much, but had some ties to mobsters and racketeers, and there was some risk, of course, that Bobby Kennedy would uncover wrongdoing by his own father if he pursued the labor rackets. So Joe may have had another motive in trying to keep his son away from this, self-protection, and Bobby's motive, unconscious, may have been to somehow rebel in some kind of almost Greek way against his own father. Hmm.
Certainly another result of this that carried on through time was his long-standing bad blood between Robert Kennedy and Jimmy Hoffa, who ran the Teamsters Union.
An obsession of RFK's. Bobby Kennedy spent years and millions of dollars trying to get Hoffa into jail. Hoffa was a pretty bad guy. He ran the Teamsters and back in the 50s and early 60s, and the Teamsters were mobbed up. There was a lot of lot to investigate there. But Bobby was obsessive about it. When he was Attorney General, he created something called the Get Hoffa Squad. They had about 40 lawyers working full time just on trying to put Hoffa in jail. He was indicted, tried several times. They finally convicted him after RFK was no longer Attorney General. But it was a little bit over the top, and although, as I say, Hoffa was a bad guy, I think that Bobby's methods and obsession with him was questionable. Hmm.
He managed his brother's campaign for the Senate and then for the presidency. He obviously was a very important confidant and also performed another important function, that is, he could, if there was dirty work to be done, he could do it, and his brother could be aloof and stay out of that. And one wonders just whether John Kennedy would have been as successful as he was had it not been for his brother and the functions and the roles that he performed.
Oh, absolutely. It's a classic good cop, bad cop. I mean, Bobby performed a crucial role for his brother, because Bobby did all the dirty work. He was the one who told the hacks to, you know, get to work or get out of there. He's the one who delivered the tough messages to political opponents, and it enabled JFK to remain that picture that we have in our own minds is this kind of cool, elegant, detached, ironic figure that is so appealing to so many of us. Well, he was able to do that because he had his tough little brother running around doing all the dirty work.
I'd like to go on and talk a little bit about the Cuban Missile Crisis, maybe one of the most important things that happened during the time that John Kennedy was president. And something that's there has been, of course, a great deal written about it. But I wonder about Robert Kennedy's role as advisor in this, because it seems that you're pointing to a role that others, when they have written about this, and haven't told us as much about it. It makes me think that perhaps he was more important here than we would have been led to believe.
Yeah. I mean, Jack Kennedy was president, so he has ultimate responsibility. But there is no question that Robert Kennedy played a crucial role in the missile crisis, and ultimately a good role. His first instinct was bad. Bobby was could be very belligerent, and his first instinct was just to bomb and invade and even stage a provocation to go to war with the Soviet Union over Cuba, which would have been a disaster. But he got over that after about the first day. And working with his brother, he gradually worked out a way of appearing to not cave into the Soviets, to take a hard line, to force them to get those missiles out of there, while at the same time making sure that we didn't back them into a corner so that they would somehow, like a cornered dog, lash out. This was a very tricky thing to do when we had very imperfect intelligence, uncertainty about what the Russians were really up to. And Bobby and Jack, operating as a team, handled it pretty masterfully. It was a close thing. It could have easily gone bad. Had it really gone bad, we might all be radioactive dust today. And so it was. I actually think it was a great moment for the country, and certainly in their friendship of them finding the right way. There's a new movie out about this, 13 Days, which does get at this with fairly accurately. I mean, there are some Hollywood elements that are not so great, but mostly the movie is a pretty accurate depiction of what happened.
Hmm. Tell me about this relationship between Robert Kennedy and this Soviet agent, Georgi Bolshakov.
Yeah, Georgi Bolshakov, I think you pronounce it Bolshakov.
Your Russian's better than mine. Yeah.
No, my Russian's terrible, but I think it's Bolshakov. Fascinating. I mean, the Kennedys never did things just in a straightforward way. They always like to have back channels and to go in the back door as well as the front door. So early in John F. Kennedy's presidency, and again, you have to recall the time. This is the height of the Cold War. The main game was facing off against the Soviet Union. There was a summit meeting between Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, and Kennedy early in his administration that went kind of badly. This is a tense time. Well, Bobby Kennedy opened up a back channel to the Kremlin, a sort of secret way of being able to talk to the Kremlin through a Soviet spy named Georgi Bolshakov, who was a GRU agent. The GRU is the Soviet military intelligence, the rough equivalent of the KGB. And it allowed the Kennedys to communicate directly with the Kremlin without having to go through the State Department and official channels. It was useful at times. It helped defuse the crisis in Berlin. But it was dangerous in the sense that you couldn't always, it wasn't always reliable. And Bobby Kennedy was burned, or felt burned, because Bolshakov kept assuring him and President Kennedy that the Soviets were not going to put missiles into Cuba. Bolshakov kept saying, we will not put missiles into Cuba. Well, of course, that was not true. The Russians did put missiles into Cuba, and much to the dismay of the Kennedys, they discovered that Bolshakov had been leading them astray. Unwittingly, I should say. I'm not sure even Bolshakov knew what his masters in Moscow were doing. But Bobby felt burned by it, and it shows you the risk of back channels. Now, he also used Bolshakov during the missile crisis to float this idea that eventually they used to get out of the crisis, which is that we would secretly, with a lot of deniability, America would agree to pull its missiles out of Turkey, its own missiles out of Turkey, if the Russians pulled their missiles out of Cuba. That later became the basis for a secret deal that ended the crisis.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is Evan Thomas. He's assistant managing editor of Newsweek magazine and also is the author of a recent biography of Robert Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, His Life, published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think another important part of the Kennedy myth has to do with civil rights and his commitment to civil rights. And I think that the book points out that it is complicated and that you probably cannot divorce civil rights as a moral issue from civil rights as a political issue.
Yeah, I mean, the Kennedys, it's one of the best stories of the Kennedys because we like to think of civil rights as purely a moral issue, and certainly they had an immense moral component. But it was hard to get civil rights done. I mean, in the real world of politics, Democratic Party, you know, that was the party of the solid South back then. It was all those white Southerners provided an awful lot of votes for the Democrats. And the Kennedys had to deal with that political reality in order to do what needed to be done, which was to integrate the South. And they did it slowly and cautiously and sort of one step forward, one step back. But they did do it. And Bobby Kennedy played a crucial role, sometimes unhappily, sometimes grudgingly, sometimes muttering and complaining the whole way about Martin Luther King and others. But he did do it. And in the end, the Kennedys did the right thing on civil rights and deserve a lot of credit for it.
Probably the most difficult period in his life was the period following his brother's assassination. He felt, apparently, that he might have been at fault.
This is a fascinating and complicated tale, but one worth telling. Bobby Kennedy's existence was defined as the protector of his brother, the guy who looked after his brother and protected him and furthered him, his cause. But at the same time, as Attorney General of the United States, he was, in his own tough-minded way, chasing the mob. We've talked about Jimmy Hoffa, you know, pursuing these mobsters in a way that had never been done before by the Justice Department or the FBI, which had been sitting on its hands. And at the same time, and less nobly, he was running these covert actions aimed at getting rid of Castro in Cuba. And Bobby Kennedy was terribly afraid in the afternoon that he heard that his brother had been shot and killed. Bobby Kennedy was afraid that he had somehow gotten his brother killed because he feared that the very people he was after, the mob and the Cubans, had somehow come back and in retaliation killed his own brother. He never got over that fear. He went to his own grave thinking that he had somehow gotten his brother killed, that the mob in retaliation had knocked off JFK.
And he did attempt to get an answer to that himself, and the answer always came back no, but he apparently didn't believe it?
Well, it came back muddy. I mean, it came back no at first. I mean, that very afternoon, as soon as he heard that his brother had been shot, he put out feelers to his spies out in Chicago to find out whether Sam Momo Giancana, who was the Don of Chicago, had killed his brother. And he quietly pursued this question in future years. In 1967, he sent his chief investigator, Walter Sheridan, who had been the head of the Get Hoffa Squad, down in New Orleans to look into all the crazy allegations coming out there from Jim Garrison. Your listeners may remember the movie JFK, which is a wholly fictional movie about the plot to kill President Kennedy. But that all began with this DA named Garrison down in New Orleans, and Bobby sent his own investigator down there to find out what was going on, and came back believing, without being sure, but believing that there was a good chance that Carlos Marcello, who was a mafia don down in New Orleans, had killed JFK. So he died with the Bobby Kennedy. When he died in 1968, he had real suspicions that the mob had killed his brother.
He certainly faced a crisis at this point, and part of it was, I think, a crisis of faith. You'd ask yourself those questions of, well, why did this happen? But also, I'm sure that the loss of his brother was important for him because he was an important figure, because he was the older brother, because he was the president. And perhaps also there may here have been some layer of his feeling that now the mantle had passed to him and that he was asking of himself, am I capable of taking it on?
I mean, yes, all of that. I mean, that's what makes his story so fascinating. Here's somebody who had, as we said at the top of the show, had been a runt and this sort of pitiful kid, and he proves himself by being a little tough guy in the service of his brother. But it's always behind the scenes. It's always working to make his brother look good. Suddenly his brother is dead, and this is unbelievably complicated. His brother is dead, Bobby fears, because of something that Bobby has done, which is hard enough. But at the same time, Bobby Kennedy has to figure out, all right, now do I pick up the mantle that my fallen brother has dropped? Do I become the leader, not just behind the scenes now, but out front, the front man, the president, I mean, the leader of the whole country? That was a very painful, difficult, agonizing decision for Robert Kennedy, and courageously, I think he made it. I mean, he did run for president in 1968.
Yeah. Let's talk about the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy, which was there was also a lot of bad blood there. I suppose it would be hard to think of two individuals when you look at their background, their style, their personality would be more different than the two of them.
Yeah, I mean, Bobby Kennedy was a sort of a sardonic, and he didn't like to be touched. LBJ was always grabbing you, clutching you, all over you, you know, slobbering on you. And so their styles were extremely different. But beyond that, Bobby had identified LBJ early in the game as a political threat to his brother. In 1960, JFK's chief rival for the Democratic nomination, the Kennedys believed and feared, was Lyndon Johnson, then the majority leader of the U.S. Senate. So he'd been signaled out by RFK as an enemy right from the get-go. And then it got worse when LBJ lost to JFK for the nomination but got the number two slot. Bobby and Johnson did not get along well. They got along terribly. And then, of course, when LBJ becomes president after JFK is dead, Bobby, in some weird and Shakespearean way, sees LBJ as a usurper sitting in his brother's throne. However irrational that may be, that's the way Bobby saw it, and treats LBJ abysmally. And LBJ treats Bobby well at first, but quickly comes to loathe him.
How was it a difficult thing for him to make the decision to run for president?
I was tortured for a lot of reasons. I mean, on a political level, all of his advisors were telling him it was stupid because he'd lose and he'd ruin his own political career and that he would divide the Democratic Party and ultimately just elect Richard Nixon, who was seen to be the likely nominee for the Republicans in 1968, and of course was, and ultimately won. And if Bobby was, on another level, if Bobby's goal at this time, professed goal, was to get us out of Vietnam. Now this, of course, is tricky because the Kennedys helped get us into Vietnam, but by 1968, Bobby wanted to get out. And he feared that if he ran and divided the Democratic Party and ended up electing Richard Nixon, instead of shortening the war, he would simply prolong it. So the whole thing would backfire, and it would be another case, and Bobby Kennedy was reading a lot of Greek tragedies at this time, another case of sort of flying too close to the sun of hubris, of overweening or overarching pride leading to a tragic end, the theme of so many Greek tragedies. And Bobby was already obsessed with this notion because of his own brother's death, this fear that by overreaching and trying too hard to prosecute his brother's enemies, he'd ended up getting his brother killed. Well, here he was faced with this decision, am I going to do this all over again? Am I going to overreach here and bring down the fates on me and get, you know, divide my party and ultimately fail? And, of course, what he was also wondering was, would he get himself killed? And he did. He got killed.
Nowadays, when there seems to be such lack of enthusiasm about candidates, about politics, it seems hard to picture, apparently, the kind of excitement that he, as candidate, generated.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, you look at those old newsreels sure doesn't look like 1996 or 2000. Bobby Kennedy is just mobbed in these scenes. In 1968, he was pulled from his car, his tooth was chipped, his shoes were stolen twice, his cufflinks would be ripped off. At the end of the day, he'd be bleeding. I mean, can you imagine that kind of voter engagement, enthusiasm today? It's just, it's just unthinkable.
I mean, it's also hard to imagine candidates letting people, in some sense, letting people get that close to them, or having their handlers let people get that close to them.
This is all pre-Secret Service. He only had one bodyguard, a former FBI agent, who would just hold him in his car while a mob. So that, you're right. I mean, physically, you can't get anywhere near a candidate. Partly because Bobby Kennedy got shot. Yeah. I mean, the security got better after Kennedy himself was shot. So that's part of it. That is part of it. But the enthusiasm of the crowds is palpable from the sidelines. It isn't just the people grabbing at him. It's the people screaming and yelling and, you know, we want Bobby and all that.
Well, it's hard to believe that people literally were trying to tear the guy's clothes off.
Right. I mean, he was a sort of a rock star, like his brother had been. Part of it was a residue of his brother's appeal. I mean, Bobby once joked, I'm a Beatle. He had some of the same draw. In fact, I said that once. I met Paul McCartney, and I said that Bobby compared himself to you, and McCartney decided that he liked Bobby even better as a result.
Well, he just was such a, and now having looked at the book, it makes me think this even more so, but such a remarkable combination of contradictions. Just even when you look at his picture, it's hard not to see this strange mixture of world weariness, you know, that look in the eyes that says he knows more than he wished, and yet at the same time, that's layered with this boyish quality that he himself, I think, projected. I don't know if that was he made an effort to do it or he just couldn't help doing it.
No, he did. I mean, you described him well. There was this haunted and ancient look in his eye, all the way back to the Greeks. I mean, this tragic look. Yet he was very boyish. He loved ice cream. You know, he squirmed like a kid. He loved children and sort of behaved like a children himself. It was a strange mix, and it was all there. I mean, he never got over being a child because, unlike his older siblings, had to grow up in a hurry. They had to be little adults right away to show what leaders they were. Bobby, relegated to the wrong end of the table, was allowed to be a child and to think like a child and to behave like a child, and he never got over that. I mean, he was in some ways always a child. I mean, you just watch him. I mean, I remember Robert Coles, this psychiatrist who was pretty close to him, describing him just eat a bowl of ice cream with such childish enthusiasm. And you look at these film clips of him sitting on a dais, and he's squirming like a little kid. So there's that whole side to him. Yet at the same time, he's haunted by the tragedy of the ages. Mm.
We have about 10 minutes left here with Evan Thomas. He is assistant managing editor of Newsweek. He is also the author of a recent biography of Robert Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, His Life, published by Simon & Schuster. We have a caller. Others are welcome. If you'd like to ask a question, 333-9455. That's for Champaign, Urbana folks. Toll free, anywhere you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, you were talking about the enthusiasm that's hard to believe today, and I can tell you from personal experience, because I was a sophomore in high school during the 68 primary in Indiana, Kennedy came to town, and they let us out of school for, an hour or so to go down to the city square. You talked in front of the courthouse, and, it was like just packed with screaming people, and I got to shake his hand as he's going out, and he tried to shake everybody's hand, and I remember being very surprised at how rough and just like a little torn up his hand seemed to be. He must have shaken thousands and thousands of hands, every day, and his complexion was really ruddy, like he was out in the sun all the time too, and I was really surprised by that, but then I thought about it later. Yeah, I mean, seeing what I saw there and just thinking about duplicating that several times a day, day after day, 7 days a week, you know. I mean, yeah. His hands looked like he'd been, you know, like digging ditches or something.
He was pretty beat up by the end. He was exhausted. He was getting about 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and he was, even though we've talked about how boyish he was also aging prematurely. He was only 42 when he was shot, and but he, if you looked in his eyes, if you looked at the skin around his eyes, he looked older than that. Even though he had this kind of mop of hair and looked a little bit like a beetle, he was aging. He was getting older. It was a grind. It was wearing on. He was shy. He was interesting. I talk sometimes to school kids about him as an example of, you may be a shy kid who thinks you're a loser, but look at his example, because he overcame all that. I mean, he made himself go out and speak to crowds and plunge into the thick of things, even though each time I think it was painful for him. He did it. And I think in some ways it fed him and fed his ego, certainly. But he had to make himself do it each and every morning, and it took a certain amount of courage to go out there.
Well, yeah, I certainly remember his face looking pretty worn and wrinkled. Yeah.
He was somebody who loved to be outdoors. A part of that, what you were saying, is he was loved to kayak and climb mountains, and he was healthy in that sense. He was also a little vain. I was amused to find out that he used a sun lamp to keep his tan through the winter.
Yeah, he was very tanned. I do remember that. You know, but it just, at the time, it just really struck me. At, you know, what his hands, you know, felt like.
Well, thanks for the call.
Sure,
I appreciate
it.
Let's go to somebody else here. Line number two, Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if could you say that that Robert Kennedy in particular, he seemed to have really have his speeches, the kind of things he would say, really hooked people. And I was just wondering if he had a kind of like some philosopher that he particularly felt you know, close to, or maybe somebody he quoted all the time, anything along those lines?
He did. He certainly did. He had a whole philosophy worked out, and it was a mixture of the ancient Greeks was what got him sort of started. But then he began reading Emerson, who writes a lot about self-reliance, and also Camus. He became an existentialist. And the philosophy he worked out, and it's most clearly explained in his famous speech in South Africa, was that even though you think that all men are doomed and the fates are going to get you sooner or later, that's not an excuse to give up. You can't just, even though you think you may be doomed, you cannot just roll over and give up. Each day, you have to get up and do the best you can. And if enough people take that attitude, over time, all these small acts of decency or courage will come together, and the collective power of those acts is enough to topple tyrannies and free the oppressed. And he gave that speech many times, most famously, as I mentioned, in South Africa, where there was apartheid, and it was a low period for blacks in South Africa, for whites too, really. And it was a kind of philosophy of his, and one that he tried to live in his own life, and I think did live in his own life. These small individual acts of courage can add up, if enough people do it, over time, to do great things.
This was on his own. His family didn't point him in that direction or anything like that?
No, Jackie Kennedy pointed him in that direction. Actually, after President Kennedy died, Bobby had a crisis of faith. They heard him crying out of them when they put him to bed that night. Why God? He cried, why God? Well, Bobby had been a good Catholic, pretty literal-minded Catholic, and he just had this crisis trying to understand how God could have allowed this to happen. And He would meet with Jackie Kennedy, who was also struggling with her own grief, and she turned him on to the Greeks, a book by Edith Hamilton called The Greek Way, and to sort of explain tragedy and fate. And that he started reading that, and he went from there to reading, as I mentioned, Camus and Emerson, also Shakespeare, pretty much on his own. I mean, he would ask people what to read, but it wasn't his family. It was his own journey.
Thank you.
Thanks. There's no doubt that running for president is an exhausting experience. I'm not sure how anyone manages to make it through. he was dealing with that. He was dealing with his own fears. How much was he also dealing with a feeling that he simply wasn't his brother's equal?
Oh, I think he was tormented by it. I mean, I think he had great feelings of insecurity. We know that as late as May of 68, he's out there in South Dakota, and crowd's a little flat, you know, his speech is not so great, and he comes off and he just says, I'm just not Jack. I just, you know, he knew that he wasn't as glamorous a figure or as good a speaker. And I think he was at other times, once in Buffalo, New York, there were huge crowds, and he looked out the window and he said, you know, they're not here for me, they're here for my brother. So he felt that insecurity all the time.
Hmm. If he had been elected, do you think that he would have been a good president?
It's hard to know for sure. I mean, I'd like to say so, but I think he would have tried some pretty bold things. He would have tried a big jobs bill to deal with poverty and the problems of race, and he would have tried to get us out of Vietnam, but those were hard things to do, and I'm not sure he would have succeeded. He did have a devious and kind of ruthless side, which was potentially dangerous, you know, some of the kind of stuff that Nixon got caught doing. I'm not so sure that Bobby Kennedy might not have tried some of the same, and maybe he wouldn't have gotten caught, but I worry about that side of RFK. I think at that moment in time, 1968, a very difficult time, I think he could have provided a kind of bold kind of leadership. But again, I just don't know whether it would have been successful. There were an awful lot of people who were fearful of Bobby and didn't like his alliance with blacks and with students and so forth. And he might not have been able to get much through Congress.
Mm. I think that for good or ill, we end up learning the most about presidents when we have the chance to see them in private moments. And sometimes this happens long after they're gone. And I wonder if in this particular case there's some private moment that you discovered or that you learned about that you would say speaks volumes about what sort of a person Robert Kennedy was.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think there are surprising moments. You know, everybody in the about an hour before he was shot, he knew that he was winning the California primary, and the legend became that he'd finally come into his own. He no longer felt under his brother's shadow. This was the great victory. He was going to sweep to the nomination in the election, and that's the whole mythology, that Bobby had finally become his own man. But other people who watched him that night saw him sitting in the corner alone, smoking a cigar, sort of awkwardly, kind of hunched up like a little kid. And that, to me, was telling, that even at his moment of triumph, when it looked like he'd banished the old ghost, even then he still was childlike and shy.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to stop there. We've come to the end of the time. We want to say thanks very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Our guest, Evan Thomas, he's Assistant Managing Editor of Newsweek magazine. The book, if you would like to read it, is Robert Kennedy, His Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster.